The Local Thread. Welcome to The Anderson Hour, part of WGTE's The Local Thread. On today's episode, Jerry looks back at the series Rethinking Jails and Justice. The topic, treating mental health.
Jails have become warehouses for people who are poor, lack housing, or suffer from mental illness or addiction. They starkly reflect America's long history of racism. Once again this month, we open with those powerful and thought-provoking words, which are not mine, nor are they those of WGTE Public Media, but rather of the Safety and Justice Challenge, a nationwide effort to rethink our local jails, to reduce inmate populations in those jails, to do that safely, by the way, and to address stark inequities in the racial makeup of our local prison populations. Welcome in. I'm Jerry Anderson today. I am struck by the phrase in that opening statement that we've been using the last few months, that jails have become warehouses for those who, and I'm going to pick up this phrase, who suffer from mental illness and addiction. Today, I want to welcome in Dr. Lori Brushman-Lovins, professor of criminology in the Department of Human Services, Bowling Green State University. Dr. Lovins, good to have you with us today. Deb Flores knows much about how we do or don't treat people with mental illness. You see, she is the chief executive officer of the ZEF Center, a behavioral health care resource in our community for almost 50 years. ZEF has been around. The ZEF Center says its mission is to, I'm going to quote here, create hope and recovery through integrated person-centered services. And one of the panelists on the Rethinking Jails and Justice live stream earlier this year was Scott Silak. Now, Mr. Silak is the executive director of the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board for Lucas County. And I should mention right here that Lucas County partnered with the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation's Safety and Justice Challenge dating back nearly a decade ago. Those efforts have yielded impressive results, especially in reducing the county jail population, down nearly 40%, we learned at that town hall earlier this year, the reduction coming without a reduction in safety. Yes, there's still crime in Toledo. There's no question about that. But there is no uptick tied to the effort to reduce the jail population. So welcome to all of my panelists. Good to have you here. Mr. Silak, let me start with you, because we need to, if not set ground rules, at least find some common ground from which to launch our discussion today. It's a point you made, I thought eloquently, at the town hall, having to do with some preconceived notions regarding people with mental illness and crime.
Yeah, so, you know, I think I mentioned at the time that individuals with mental illness are more likely to be victims than they are perpetrators. They are also not associated with criminality the way people have a tendency to think. The individuals, just because they're mentally ill, doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to be criminals, right? You can have a mental illness and live a full life to the fullest extent. You can work, have a family, kids. Doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to commit a crime. There are other individuals, though, that have a criminal intent, criminalistic thinking, mm-hmm. that also have a mental illness. And I think that's kind of where things get a little blurry for people outside of, you know, the treatment systems and general public.
Well, you said to the audience, both at the McMaster Center, at the main library, and the audience watching and listening as we were streaming that night, that yes, sometimes people with a mental illness commit crimes, just as people who don't have a mental illness sometimes commit crimes. But having a mental illness does not predispose you to becoming a criminal. Fair?
Fair, yes.
Dr. Lori Lovins, I know that that is something that's important to you as well, something you wanted to stress to our viewers. And I'm guessing you want to impress upon your students down there in the criminal justice program in criminology. Where do you take it? How do you express it? And why is it important that people understand that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that I stress is that Mental health is actually not one of the central eight risk factors associated with recidivism. And recidivism is really a measure that we look at when someone does get arrested for a crime. Mm-hmm. What is one of the predictors that tell us, are they going to be rearrested? So are they going to be one of those people who come in and out of the criminal justice system? So we know that there are other factors like who a person spends time with. Do they spend time with people that engage in other peers that engage in criminal behavior? Do they have personality attributes like impulsivity and aggressiveness and lack of empathy or remorse, lack of problem-solving abilities? Do they have employment issues or lack of education? And substance abuse is one of the risk factors as well that does tend to predict criminality. But mental health does not rise to the top in terms of one of the major predictors of recidivism. So, you know, there is this association of mental health because we do have an influx of people in our criminal justice system that have mental health conditions, but it's not because people with mental illness tend to commit a lot of crimes.
Deb Flores, I want to get you in here. Ms. Flores, the Chief Executive Officer over at the Zeff Center. And I know you've wanted to just blow up some of these preconceived and inaccurate notions, the stereotypes that people have. Oh, they're mentally ill, they're going to become a criminal. We have people with mental illness arrested, charged, convicted, incarcerated at levels that far exceed the percentage of their makeup to the population in general. They are overrepresented in our prison population. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
How so?
Well, I think that prior to the pandemic, we know that one in four had some level of a mental illness. Someone in this room could have a defined anxiety.
Statistically, somebody does.
Yeah. Yep. And so I think that a lack of resources would lead to that. And so one of our contracts with the Bureau of Federal Prisons, my team tells me what the challenges are, and those are resources. So sometimes when you don't have access to care, and so people could be diagnosed with mental illness. How long have they had these challenges? Are they in treatment somewhere? Do they have someone providing them medication, housing? All of those factors create what you're talking about, the numbers to be disproportionate.
I had the honor for several years of helping to publicize and then lead the walk every year for NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. We would do it out there at the UTMC. Great organization. And they were the ones that impressed on me that one in four people will deal with mental illness in their lifetime. I bounced that off of you the other day and said it's probably worse than that now.
Correct.
Tell me about that.
Research is showing us that it's one in three. And I think as a result of the pandemic, one of the things that people need is connection. And when you're isolated, that's the opposite of connection. And so if the young people in our community were not in schools and they didn't have access to therapeutic services and connection, you're isolated. And the same thing, if you're incarcerated and you come back to a community, it may not be the community that you lived in before. How do you find those connections? You have this label on your forehead that says, don't hire me, don't house me, don't associate with me.
Is it an interesting, for those of you who've been with us month after month, some of the recurring themes? A month ago, we were talking about youth crime, juvenile crime, gang crime in Toledo, and that was one of the things that was pointed out as it pertains to the pandemic, this separation from people, this time on their hands, kids away from connections, and the what that has led to. Clearly on this program, we want to get to, when we're already started down that road, thank you, guests, of the why of our situation. But first, let's define some of the terms you're going to hear today, starting with mental illness itself, because we know it's not just one thing, clearly. But that phrase encompasses a variety of illnesses. So just what are we referring to when we probe mental illness? I just did air quotes there for you. Mental illness in the criminal justice system.
So I think about it as a defined set of symptoms that can be diagnosed, like anxiety and stress, that can be measured, that can be addressed via a medication, and is not usually correlated with, are you having a bad mental health day, right? People use mental health and mental illness interchangeably. Mental health can be positive or it can be negative. Mental illness, again, is a disease. It's a chemical imbalance in the brain. If you do not address your mental health symptoms over time, they can develop into mental illness.
Hmm. It's not unusual to have an occasional down day. I'm a little blue today. But when those feelings get to the point that now they are directing my activities of that day, what I choose to do, not to do, then we're getting into an area, now we're approaching depression. But also when we talk about mental illness, we are talking about, you know, I'm not the doctor here, but let's toss out the word schizophrenia. I mean, some of these things are so, so deep and so, so stark that we have to address those. That's part of our issue in what we're talking about.
Well, it's definitely a severe and persistent mental illness,
right.
Schizophrenia. To Scott's point, someone who may be experiencing depression with medication and some ongoing treatment, therapeutic treatment, they have full ability to live a life of recovery. I think sometimes with schizophrenia, there tends to be more barriers to that life of recovery. Medication compliance, there's new advancements in medication that long-acting injectables we know can go up to 6 months now. It used to be a shot weekly, then it was once a month, then every 3 months. But medication adherence does not always, I think Scott also said this earlier, we can't force people to take that medication unless it's court-ordered or through a guardian, and that's a long, lengthy process. And so sometimes those medications just don't make you feel any better. And so it is, I think the challenges with schizophrenia are more profound.
Dr. Levins, would you like to weigh in on that, joining us on the telephone today from down in Southern Ohio?
Yeah, I think when you look at the intersection between mental health and then the criminal justice system,
yep,
you have the kind of added issue of, in jails, for example, 1 in 4 experience serious psychological distress, which certainly go along with the experience of incarceration. And really, the only, you know, the major treatment when you're talking about confinement is going to be medication. You know, there's not a whole lot of other treatment options. There is programming that's brought into jails, but when we're talking about, you know, managing mental illness, and, you know, especially the onset of serious psychological distress, you know, we're really looking at managing that with medication. And one of the issues with confinement is that only about 25% of those who are experiencing psychological distress actually get treatment. And so, you know, a small portion of those who are experiencing those symptoms are actually getting interventions for that. And so that becomes, you know, a real issue within confined settings. And they've talked about prisons being kind of the new, you know, the new mental health institutions, where because there are so few beds available in the community for people with mental health, you know, especially chronic and persistent mental health issues, that those individuals are, you know, becoming treated within the criminal justice system, which I can promise you is not the place that they're going to get the best kind of mental health care.
Would either of you here in studio, Scott Silak or Deb Flores, like to follow up on that?
Sure, I'd like to say a few words on that. I think there's differing levels of accountability, right? Individuals that break a social norm, you know, a law that has been established due to their mental illness, I believe should have a different level of accountability than somebody who's more criminogenic in nature and requires some level of incarceration, right? We have laws in place to protect some of those folks, you know, the incompetent that stay in trial, non-restorable, you know, that can move people in the hospitals. But by and large, what we see in Lucas County is the recurring theme of individuals doing small, victimless type crimes that have a substantially, and I think this is important to recognize, untreated mental illness that have a tendency to clog up our local jails and then also clog up the state hospital and local private psychiatric hospital beds. If we were able to resolve through, you know, better access, as Deb has pointed out, more resources, if we could dramatically impact that population, I think we could do quite a bit of good work in resolving some of the more high-level social consequences of the untreated illness.
Okay. Let's stay right there, because somebody mentioned to me, and as I dug around and did background on this, percentage of inmates that are incarcerated in our society who have either mental illness or substance abuse problems is
70% locally.
Did you hear that, folks? Let's do that again. 70%. When I first heard that, I said, no, that can't be right. But again, I was combining mental illness, 40%-ish, 35, in somewhere in there, and substance abuse. You put those together. And Dr. Lori Lovins, I think that you indicated as well that one of the largest risk factors out there for people who do live with mental illness is substance abuse, especially long-term substance abuse.
Yeah, I mean, when you see an individual with a mental health diagnosis that is justice involved, about 75% of those individuals are also going to have a co-occurring substance use disorder. So we tend to see those hand in hand often, again, when they're a justice involved individual. So that co-occurring illness is really important to treat. And we know that the best treatment for that becomes co-occurring treatment. For a long time, we tried to push those individuals into one silo or another. Oh no, you need to get the mental health treated first in order to treat the in order to address the substance use, or no, you got to go get that substance use addressed first before we can address mental health. And we know now that none of that works, that integrated care is really the only way to adequately address people with co-occurring illnesses. But yes, those definitely tend to co-occur together. And that's, you know, that's an area where trying to find, either integrated care on a residential or inpatient level or even outpatient becomes really, you know, can be a challenge for, you know, justice-involved people or even non-justice-involved people.
You're listening to Rethinking Jails and Justice, a forum produced by WGTE Public Media. This follows our examination of the National Safety and Justice Challenge, a program undertaken by Lucas County leaders here nearly a decade ago. By the way, WGTE Public Media is producing a series of podcasts that kick off in early September, running through the fall, hosted by Jason Hibbs of Bowling Green State University. You're going to want to check those out. With me in studio, Deb Flores, Chief Executive Officer over at the ZEF Center. Scott Silek is here, Executive Director of the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board in Lucas County. Dr. Lori Lovins on the staff, professor. Is it Professor of Criminal Justice, Professor of Criminology? I'm not quite sure.
Criminal Justice.
There we go. Good to have you with us on the phone. So we're talking about, well, let me try this one on. The labeling, incorrectly as it turns out, but it's out there. All criminals must be people with a mental illness. And I think that goes to the vast majority of us who just can't comprehend willingly breaking a law. And I'm not talking about we walk on water and we're goody two-shoes. It's just the prospect of being caught is enough of a deterrent to control our behavior. I mean, if I got caught, the public humiliation, the embarrassment to my family, loss of work, possible incarceration, da, da, da. It's enough to keep us from breaking laws. So are you telling me one can't deduce that those for whom consequences hold lesser meaning have something that's mentally wrong? Doesn't that kick in? Help me out with this.
Well, I think that you could look at, there's a tool called ACEs. It's the Adverse Childhood Impact. And they look at 10, and I think they've added two questions for young people.
Okay.
And it is, you know, what type of childhood trauma have you had? So you think about a young person, you said, you guys talked about this a few weeks ago, that Bridges Out of Poverty has trained us that many times young people in poverty don't have a future story. Their frontal lobe is not fully developed, and so their decision making is oftentimes impacted by their childhood experiences. And so at Zeph Center, you know, you talked about integrated care.
Mm-hmm.
We're certified as a trauma-informed organization. Doesn't mean we just use trauma-informed tools. It means that we take the approach of not what's wrong with you, Jerry, but what happened to you? What happened to you so we can understand and help figure out what is the best course of treatment for you? And so, especially with young people, you're looking at, we had a person who worked for us. We all took the ACEs tool and she said, oh my gosh, my ACEs score is 8 out of 10. And I said, and you are breaking all the barriers, you know, you're doing well. But when you look at the scoring, and there's a doctor out of, I can't think of where she comes from, but she actually got the California Board of Education, the entire state, to ensure that we screened young people in before they start school to see what their ACE score is and help them really develop a way to work with young people that have experienced that level of trauma. How does your brain recover from some of the things that no one would wish on their worst enemy?
Scott Sanlick, I think you have indicated that, hey, Jer, be careful before you go down that road of, well, if they're committing a crime and deciding that it's okay for them to do, they must have a mental illness. Let's also recognize that we've had different upbringings, and you've alluded to that, Deb, obviously, that these are social behavioral norms, maybe not mental health norms we're talking about.
Yeah, I entirely agree with that. And, you know, I agree with what Deb said. But as we think about the way laws are formed and who forms them, the culture that develops laws and approves laws may not necessarily be the culture and isn't the culture that is often overrepresented in our criminal justice system, right? Access to resources, access to stable housing, the inequities of the past, discrimination that is undeniable in institutions, all those things lead up to establishing values and then acting out on those values through, you know, your cognitive filters, and mm-hmm. then those filters have consequences. In you reference that individuals, you know, you were scared to death of doing a certain thing.
Absolutely.
Some people may have to do that to survive or to even eat. And that's the difference.
Yeah. Scott suggested to me an earlier conversation one time, said, yeah, but Jerry, you live in that nice home there in Bowling Green. Let's say you haven't slept for 3 days because you don't have a home to sleep in. You haven't eaten for 3 days. Your hunger is overwhelming. And there's a pizza guy. I know I could roll. Right? And then all of a sudden, my point of view might have changed a little bit from this. Well, I could never do that because it's just the wrong thing to do and I don't want to get caught. Circumstances and where a person is in life can absolutely change their behavior, and clearly does in this case.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that doesn't mean it's wrong, right? Or it's not wrong.
It's not,
yeah,
yeah.
It's not wrong.
Yeah.
It is wrong.
It is wrong, yeah.
Right? And oftentimes, and I think the doctor could probably speak to this a little more, is that's that criminogenic nature as well, right? Those criminal thinking errors that I'm sure the doctor's well-versed on about, oh, I don't think I'm going to get caught, or I won't get caught, or I'm smarter than everybody else. Those kinds of things lead people to do things that you and I may not do because we have some level of reasoning that maybe those criminogenic thinking errors, they're not embedded in us.
Dr. Levins, Scott Sadlak just set you up beautifully. I want you to run with that. And I want to commit this word now to my vocabulary. Criminogenic?
Criminogenic. Yes.
Criminogenic. All right, Dr. Levins, weigh in for me, please.
Yes, and please call me Lori. And I think the way Scott defined mental illness before is really important, because I think the problem is people thinking very broadly about mental illness and then about criminal behavior, and then thinking, especially with the more heinous, you know, crimes. I entered the field working with people who committed sex offenses. And when you think about those kind of crimes, like, you have to be mentally ill to engage in that kind of behavior. But when you think about defining mental illness, like, absolutely not. Like, those people who, you know, people who engage in those kinds of heinous behaviors don't necessarily have a diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or, you know, some of those mental health conditions. It may absolutely be more an issue of sexual deviance, or it may be an issue of criminal thinking, or an issue of a, you know, criminal personality or temperament issue related to impulsivity. It may be other, you know, psychological distresses, stressors compiled with criminal thinking that kind of culminates into a decision in a moment that, you know, leads to legal problems. And so, you know, it tends to be multiple factors that come together, not mental illness, that leads to criminal involvement.
Dr. Laura Levins, our guest on the staff at Bowling Green State University. She's a professor down there at BGSU. In studio with us, Deb Flores, Chief Executive Officer over at the Zeff Center. Scott Sadlak, Executive Director, Mental Health and Recovery Services Board here in Lucas County. All right, so now let's get to this. As we look at the Safety and Justice Challenge, and we're trying to reduce the inmate population, seems to me one quick way is to put fewer people in the first place. Doesn't mean some people don't have to go there, but, you know, we don't have to reduce a population if the population isn't in there from the get-go. Where do those people go, however, if not to jail? I don't think we're going out and saying, get him, put him in jail. I mean, there's something that initiates this. So where do those people go that we're putting in jail that we don't believe need to be in jail?
So if I could jump in,
please.
I think that when Zeff Center became the crisis center, one of the desires was for the community out of the CPES report, which was, what does our community need? What does future state look like? Was to create the diversion or the diversion concept for law enforcement. So they get a call, someone is, they might be doing public urination, public indecency, some kind of behavior that most of the storefronts don't want that in their place of business or whatnot.
Right.
They call 911, they go there, bring them to us. We have plenty of clothes, we have food, we will help find out what's going on with this person so that they can not go to jail. So we divert them from jail. And looking at the data, we could synthesize, where are you diverting them from? Are you diverting them from a shelter? Are you diverting them from jail? Are you diverting them from a hospital? And so we also looked at, what was this person going to be charged with? Anything from, there's been public trespassing, public nudity, to it could be a case of domestic violence or aggressive behavior in the streets, whatever it might be. But what we created was the opportunity for law enforcement to bring them to us to defer them from the jail, mostly. But also hospitals, because we have a crisis stabilization unit, they can stay with us instead of being admitted to a hospital level of care.
Your capacity is not an issue.
Capacity could be an issue. Today, this entire week, we've been at full capacity in our 16-bed unit because it's hot out. People are looking for a safer place to be. And they are more willing to be admitted to our unit because it's voluntary than they would normally.
In my many years chasing police, in my lifetime as a TV news guy, chasing police to crime scenes for coverage on our evening news, I've learned so much about everything cops on a crime scene have to deal with, and it's just kind of overwhelming. Are we training them to spot a potential mental illness situation when they are called to a crime scene? Or to be honest, are we just asking too much of them in these what are clearly high-stress, face-to-face scenarios?
So in Lucas County, we've had what we call crisis intervention team training with law enforcement since 2000. It was created in conjunction, collaboration with the National Alliance of Mental Illness Toledo region. We hold 4 sessions per year. We can train law enforcement officers 26 at a time. So we get about 100 new people trained each year. Okay. And that's not just law enforcement officers, but corrections officers, hospital security staff, probation officers. We've trained bailiffs, 180th Fighter Wing security MPs. And basically what this training does is it helps law enforcement officers de-escalate a situation, understand that they might be dealing with someone who is in a psychiatric, emergency, how they might de-escalate the situation, and then what resources are available in our community that they may divert that individual. Ultimate goals are safety of the officer, safety of the individual, and ongoing treatment needs, addressing the ongoing treatment needs of that individual, so those conditions and contacts don't reoccur.
Do we feel that that is having an impact locally, the training you've talked about? Are we seeing that people that, a decade ago might have gone directly to jail, who are now being taken to places like you've been talking about, Deb?
I think Scott can speak to, he's been working on this longer, but I think when you look at what's happening nationally, and I'm a part of a national organization that is about 250 CEOs, and there is so much more opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're working right now on creating additional opportunities. I think it is fundamental to do the CIT training. Absolutely. But I think that there are communities doing a lot more, and there's communities doing not even what we're doing. So I think we have been innovative, and I think that our community is open. They just want to know what can we do with this person? It's the 10th time we've been called out for so-and-so for this behavior. And it oftentimes is the resources and my team sitting down with them to find out what's really going on that you are doing these type of things to continually get yourself in trouble.
I'm a Toledo police officer out on the street. Mm-hmm. I have a person that needs to, they've acted in a way that violates our laws. Nobody's been killed, nobody's been injured, but okay. Is it faster for me to take them down to jail, drop them off, or is it faster for me to drop them out and take them over to you and do all that paperwork?
They're not doing any paperwork when they drop them
so
off
it's,
to us.
So it's actually very efficient for them to drop it off?
We would think it would be.
Okay, very good. Diversion concept, and in my notes you just mentioned, Scott, that has been part of the local safety and justice challenge, as well as the whole risk assessment team. People who can go into our local jail, conduct interviews, find that this person, they're not a violent person, they do have issues. They can come up with it. They have a stable home to go to if you were to release them, Your Honor. Make a report for a judge. In the diversion program, which I didn't take any shots at during our town hall, but I did point out that generally when it comes to crime and criminal behavior, the people in my experience that tend to get that, they get a diversion program. If they just take some classes about how what they did was wrong and how they should handle their emotions in the future, and if they pay a fine, they can go their separate way. And most of these people come from, to me, white-collar families, got great lawyers, they got all that stuff that a lot of other people in the criminal justice system don't have. You talked about it's kind of the same when you talk about a diversion concept as well. Do they have a place to go? Can they be better served someplace else? Do they need to be in jail? Is that how it applies to our local criminal justice system?
Yeah, so let's go back to there are different levels of accountability. Mm-hmm. right? And those individuals that come in contact with law enforcement due to their mental illness or substance use may very well be held accountable in different ways than individuals who commit a offense who are not mentally ill or have substance use. It really depends on the nature of the crime, the victim, stuff like that, right? And so what we know, though, is that, you know, we have a screening at the jail. It's called the public safety assessment. And what it's really doing is looking at those things that you identified and determining not only if those things are, you know, is substance or substance use or mental health likely a contributing factor, but will you actually return to court? And that's a big factor in determining if you get a release or not. And I believe, I don't know the data offhand, but I believe the individuals who are higher likelihood of returning to court are actually getting released and actually are returning to court. So that's a good thing, when, because the longer you stay in jail, the more likely you are you're going to have problems. So then it really turns to, you know, what happens once you get released. And, you know, we have teams in the jail. The Safety and Justice Challenge has created the Opportunity Project, but it's also made some changes around how individuals get diversion. They've eliminated the cost of the diversion program. So it's now based on the individual assets and willingness to, you know, personal assets, not financial assets, and their willingness to participate in a diversion. So you no longer have to pay a $300 to get out of jail free, you know, that kind of thing, which has substantially improved the accessibility and equity of that program diversion. In and of itself.
Okay. Dr. Lori Levins, I've been waiting for the right time to get you back in here, because you bring another set of eyes to this. You worked down in Houston for a time, taught down in Houston, and are familiar with a program down there in this arena, in this space. Tell me what was going on down there that impressed you.
Yeah, Deb mentioned that, you know, the importance of the crisis response team trainings, and that there's a range of, you know, jurisdictions that do, you know, really good work in this area, and, you know, and no work in this area in terms of training officers in how to respond to mental health crises and calls. And so one of the things that Houston was doing, Harris County, and I was on an evaluation team for this this pilot program, is they had a co-responder unit, so a CERT team, where those, and Lucas County has one as well, where they have a mental health clinician who responds with an officer on scene when it is a mental health-related 911 emergency, so that a clinician can help evaluate what to do in that that type of emergency. Does the person need kind of mental health care? Is a kind of law enforcement or kind of legal response more appropriate? So should that person be taken to jail, or is it appropriate to leave the person on scene?
This is a person who travels with law enforcement?
Yes. The problem is it's costly, right? Because you have typically a master level clinician that you know accompanies the call, and you know they can't be everywhere for these types of calls, right? And so they're often not available for the range of calls that come in. And especially in a place like Harris County, which is, you know, one of the largest cities in the country. And so, and they had one team for the entire jurisdiction. And so one of the things they did is they used technology to help create a force multiplier. So instead of having the clinician in the vehicle with the officer, they had them in an office with an iPad, and that allowed the officer to call in to a clinician who was then available to do a consult and even hand the iPad to the person in crisis to be able to talk to that individual and help the officer decide what might be the best route in terms of handling that that particular crisis in that moment.
Do we have a program like that locally?
Well, I think what Dr. Lovins is representing is our relationship with ZEF Center's emergency services and law enforcement.
Okay.
We do not have a true co-responder model, but what we have right now as we work towards a co-responder model is a very strong relationship with law enforcement, where if an emergency services worker is on scene, they can contact law enforcement or they can call law enforcement and they can arrive together or vice versa. So it's not the true co-responder model that Dr. Lovins is referencing, but that's something that in our last levy, 2024 levy campaign, we indicated that if it passed, that's something that we would be initiating.
And it passed.
And it did pass, yes.
Yes. All right. So we're on it. We'll be watching.
We're on it.
For anybody out there, and I'm sure that there are folks who say, well, you know what, this whole area, the whole mental illness thing, it's going to cost us an arm and a leg to deal with. I came across something that read, a 90-day treatment in a mental hospital might well prevent a 10-year or more very expensive imprisonment of an individual with mental illness. Deb Flores heard that and said to me, Jer, get real. Nobody gets 90 days of treatment. Let's go there. Why not?
Well, I think my statement was follow the money.
Yeah.
If we're talking about the Medicaid population, which is 80% of the people we serve at ZEF Center, they're either Medicaid or board funded, which means they're funded out of Lucas County funds. There is not a hospital situation in our community that will have anyone stay 90 days at
doesn't
this
happen.
Moment in time. It doesn't happen. Resources are limited now, and I think I also said on the addiction side of the house, we have hundreds of detox beds in this community now. Follow the money. You can make money in SUD services.
Yeah,
you can,
don't get too inside baseball.
Okay.
Do SUD, whatever that is?
Substance use disorder.
Okay. I'm following here that money for people with substance abuse to deal with them flows freely. Money to deal with people fighting a mental illness, not so much. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The reimbursement rates for substance use disorder treatment, organizations can make a margin. So they're able to run a detox unit, a residential unit for 30, 60, 90 days. And that doesn't exist on the mental health side.
Why not?
Hospitals, if they admit a patient, maybe a 3 to 5 day stay.
Will be reimbursed.
It'll be reimbursed and then they discharge.
So if I may jump in a little bit on that, if you think about it, what Deb is referencing is there isn't a treatment reimbursement rate for mental health residential services like there are on the substance use side. So the hospitals get a...
And that's a call made by whom, Scott?
That is a call made by our state department, the governor's office, the Ohio Department of Medicaid.
Medicaid, okay.
Right on down the line. There are states that have the ability, that have changed that in their plan. And what happens then is hospitals get a reimbursement rate, which they call, not to get too technical, a diagnostic group rating with payment of somewhere between, on the average of 4 days. And so if they release somebody in 3 days, they make a margin. If they release somebody in five, they lose. But they can stay as long as, they can stay as longer, but the hospital doesn't get a reimbursement rate for that. So so it's very difficult for hospitals who need to make money in order to stay open. And they're not making tons of money, but they do need to make money, just like Deb's unit needs to make money so that it can stay open.
Wow. So the system is set up in such a way that somebody is starting to get treatment for 3 days. They are cut loose. They're not close to being where we want them or need them to be in terms of mentally healthy. And we know we're cutting them loose, but gosh darn it, the money pit, the money has run dry.
So one of the solutions that we have worked on with the hospital systems is a step-down unit, which is at Zeph Center. Okay. We have the 16 beds, and we're able to coordinate with the hospital systems. If we think that 3 days, they stabilized your medication, they looked at, you know, they're not doing the social work of the hospitals. They're checking your medication, they're looking at your diagnosis, and they can step them down to us. They call, we pick them up, and we will admit them to our crisis stabilization unit. And that is working. But again, it's limited. It's 16 beds. And this is Lucas County. So when people admit from Flower Hospital, they say we're servicing 26 counties.
Wow.
And I assume your beds stay full, Deb.
We do trend pretty high. At least one of our requirements from the Lucas County Mental Health Board is to keep 14 beds filled.
And you generally do that.
We do. Yeah. We do. And on an average, about 5 days, you know, again, ours is voluntary. The hospital systems, they can be involuntarily committed to them for so many days. Right. With ours, it is a voluntary stay. And so between 3 and 5 days, my team is able, we have a psychiatrist, we have nursing staff, we have the ability to look at their case plan, we have care coordination, if they need housing, if they need clothing, we have all of those resources that we connect them with to ensure before they leave us, they have that.
I'm still back here, though, with the state Medicaid folks who hold the purse strings in the state of Ohio. And I'm hearing that you need substance abuse treatment. The spigot is open. I'm hearing that on the mental health side, it's open for a couple of days. And Deb Flores, you mentioned something to me as we talked earlier. With mental illness, we tend to be dealing with lifelong issues. Substance abuse, on the other hand, if we get somebody well, and if they follow the rules, they stay clean, we can heal them. It sounds to me like this is a system that is picking winners to say, substance abuse, we can clean them up, the mental illness people. That's just what I'm taking from the way these dollars are flowing. Am I way out of line here?
Well, I think that the state made this transition when they did what was called behavioral health redesign. They put the managed care plans in charge of Medicaid patients, and it was a result of the opiate epidemic. Mm-hmm. You know, Ohio was core to it. So it is kind of the no good deed goes unpunished. They thought they were doing the right thing as people have addiction issues. Thankfully, at the Zeph Center, it goes to kind of the conversation, I'm not sure if it was Dr. Lovins or Scott that said, what came first, the mental illness or the substance use? How do you treat a co-occurring disorder? Mm-hmm. You can't just treat one. And so if someone comes into our crisis stabilization unit, we can also then transition them into a residential SUD level of care. But that doesn't exist all over Ohio. And it is costly. And so I know that we have advocated for more, which is a per diem rate for somebody in a crisis stabilization unit. And I explained it that if you're in a detox stay, we get close to $400 for you. That includes your foods, your linens, your doctor, your nurse time, your programming. On the crisis stabilization unit, we get nothing. If you see the psychiatrist, we can bill for that. There are days that people are in bed and say, I can't get up. They're not going to go to group. They're not going to see the doctor. And we work around what's going on, but there's no rate to reimburse then.
Wow. Fascinating. Troubling, but fascinating.
Very complicated.
You also point out that the people you deal with, they are there by choice.
Yes.
It's voluntary.
On the crisis stabilization unit, yes.
Okay.
On the detox or residential, there could be a court involvement. We are the federal pretrial and probation organization that was selected by the Bureau of Federal Prisons, and we have a couple of other programs where the felony court, felony treatment court and things like that where they could be mandated, but it is not a locked unit. So if they walk out, they suffer the consequences of the judge, the courts, and whatnot.
Well, you've indicated to me that there are cases where a judge will tell somebody, I think it'd be really good if you got treatment. Yes, sir, I'll do that. And, of course, what is the phrase you use when they walk out of court and they do what?
They go into the wind.
They go into the wind. That's the phrase I was looking for. And you, frankly, as you point out, I don't have the money, the resources to go chase these folks.
That's correct.
So they're just out there.
In the wind.
In the wind.
Mandated by the court is a bit different than probated. Right? Because, you know, mandated
yes.
just means that there's going to be consequences followed up by the court if you don't, right? They still have choices. They can choose to go in front of the judge again, and if they didn't follow through with the recommendations by the treatment provider, then the judge chooses what to do with that, which may be a revocation of probation, or it may be a continuation with additional stipulations on their conditions. So it just means that you're going to go see the judge and there's going to be, right, potential consequences. So, yeah.
I want each of these forms to be solution-oriented. So I'd like each of you to specify an action step you'd like to see taken and by whom that step needs to be taken, and give us at least one takeaway you'd like to leave the audience with. All right, there's a whole lot going on there. Action step, Scott Silak, by whom, and one thing you want to leave with the audience.
So my action step would be for the Ohio Department of Medicaid to create a emergency services, crisis stabilization, Medicaid reimbursement rate. So seek a waiver from the federal government to do that. My takeaway that I'd like everybody to think about
now,
is...
Now, wait a minute. Who would take that action step?
The Ohio Department of the Ohio Department of Medicaid would take that action step.
Okay. They can do this unilaterally. It's not a legislative step. They don't need the legislature.
Well, they would have to... I mean, yes, there's quite a bit associated with that. Yeah. Mainly, where does the match money come from? Which then the legislators would have to initiate an allocation, right?
Okay.
So there's a whole bunch of complicated process, but it is doable. Other states have done it. What that would do is create all these next level services, step down units from the hospitals that Deb is talking about, because there'd be a rate that people would able to develop those services. Mm-hmm. What I'd like folks to consider when, you know, as a takeaway is as substance use and mental illness take hold in your body, the longer you wait for treatment, the more damage that is done. Some of that damage is irreversible. Obviously, there's physical damages to the brain, but there's also social consequences and damages to relationships. So getting help sooner is always better.
Dr. Lori Levins, give me an action step to be taken by whom, and one takeaway you'd want to leave with the audience.
You know, I'm getting increasingly concerned that we were going in a really good direction on focusing on, just as the safety and justice challenge has focused on decreasing our jail populations. We've done a good job, a good start at decreasing prison populations,
yep.
But, you know, we're starting to see a lot of, you know, kind of reverting, and some states that are passing legislation around ways to increase penalties for crimes and moving in the opposite direction, which is really concerning because we know the ramifications of keeping people in prisons and jails longer. So I would say state legislation that looks at, keeping people in jails and prisons for shorter periods of time, not longer periods of time. And so, I mean, that to me would be what I would look at, as an action step. The takeaway to me would be, while people with mental health conditions are not as likely to, or any more likely to, commit crimes, there is very clear data that they are more likely to be revoked from probation and parole because they have a harder time successfully completing those terms and conditions. And so they are going to be coming back into the system more often, just because of having to follow all the numerous conditions that we put them under when they're on terms of supervision. And so we do need, as a criminal justice system, we need to be better at creating more, specialized caseloads and more flexibility with how we handle people with mental health. And there's definite data to support things like, well-run courts, specialized caseloads, and doing a good job. And Lucas County is really known for this, working directly with mental health providers in the community and forming good relationships.
Let's get Deb Flores from the Zeff Center into our... Thank you, Lori, yeah, and exactly. Deb Flores, hang in there, from the Zeff Center. Give me a takeaway and an action step.
I think the continued celebration of wins, we talk about all the challenges, but we don't see the success when the system works. My team works with the courts, the hospitals, the mental health board, community partners on one person. And when we have a plan and we work together and we have the same vision for that person, mm-hmm. people are safe in our community. So talking about those wins and what it took to get that, I think that's the, I try to do that a lot. Scott's, his magic wand was the one I have. Provider organizations need to be paid for the work they're doing. We can't stay open without it. So advocating for parity, we've talked about this in the primary care space. If I see my doctor and he looks in my ear, he gets $200. If my psychiatrist sees a patient with schizophrenia, we get $133. There's not parity.
Also interesting to me, just in this wrap-up portion of our conversation, in our last program, 1 month ago, concerns were voiced about progress we had made. And remember, this was in the area of youth crime, criminal justice, gang violence and stuff. We had been making progress. And then, similar to what Lori Levins just told us, see some reversion, going back away from programs that seem to be working because there is pressure out there. Get those kids, put them in jail, da-da-da-da-da. There's political pressure in some cases. And when I heard Lori said that, just struck me that, man, maybe we're backtracking here. Maybe we're going back and doing some things the old ways when we see some things that are working and we need to celebrate those wins, as Deb Flores points out. Hey, listen, I want to thank all of my guests today. Deb Flores from the Zeff Center, where she is the Chief Executive Officer. Dr. Lori Levins, Professor of Criminal Justice, Bowling Green State University. And Scott Silak, Executive Director of the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board here in Lucas County. The issues are important. Your input today, very, very much appreciated. So I thank each and every one of you. It is important. I'm going to leave us where we started today, at a 70% mark of the people in our prisons are fighting mental illness and or substance abuse. If we need to get that number under control, we've got to work and work hard in this space. This is Rethinking Jails and Justice, an examination of the Safety and Justice Challenge, sponsored nationally by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. I'm Jerry Anderson. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to all of you for being out there. And let's be sure to talk again.
Thank you for joining us for The Anderson Hour, part of WGTE's The Local Thread. The Anderson Hour can be heard Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org. The Rethinking Jails and Justice series is produced by WGTE Public Media and is made possible by support from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation as part of the Safety and Justice Challenge, which seeks to reduce over-incarceration by changing the way America thinks about and uses jails.